most famously Shaq is the love.
Right.
Abdul Bash is another guy who's still there.
Uh-huh.
But we like everyone's concentrated on Shaq because thinking one by one is better than like confusing people with lots of names.
Okay.
And also because the government couldn't care less about
Shaq has got more ties here, families, children.
Right. And he's got more information about what went on in Guantanamo.
Yeah. Not only information, but he was elected to represent people there.
Okay.
And he was in the negotiation with all the generals, and he knows
details
inside. And this is what makes them even more apprehensive about
letting him go.
Yeah. Because they think he's going to be an embarrassment.
Right. I just wanted to ask about the settlement as well, because were there any strings attached with the settlement?
Well, we can't speak. Yeah, there are some. Not like people in Brighton said he was told to keep quiet to accept them, which isn't the case.
Uh-huh.
Like the report in the Evening Argus. Yeah, we were told to keep quiet.
Right, so and none of that's true.
No, that's not true.
No. Well, yeah, I think that's an important piece of information.
No, that's what really worried me. It was 24 hours afterwards. I mean, I sent you a frantic email, didn't I? Just basically going like, they haven't gagged you over there.
I couldn't
I was just imagining.
Imagine that, though. Seriously. Yeah. I don't know.
No, because the interesting thing is that they haven't been obliged to drop their claims against the government. None of it. It hasn't affected what they say happened.
Right.
Yeah.
They didn't say you have to change
what you think about that in the media.
Drop
the case and accept settlement. And the things which really they've censored is do not mention what the details are in the money, how much the amount.
Okay, it's too embarrassing.
So actually, I think that what they don't want discussing is the amount and is the details of the negotiations. Yeah.
Are you involved in the negotiations now?
Yeah,
I had a lawyer hearing these guys meeting with lawyers again. I didn't know. It was a complete surprise to me.
Okay. Well, I'm here with Omid De Gijs and Andy Worthington and Polly Nash for Sheffield Indie Radio, and we're just having a little chat about the screening tonight of Outside the Law, stories from Guantanamo. And I'd like to ask Andy about... I've interviewed Polly earlier, and she was saying that the kind of inspiration, in a way, for making the film was your work, your book about Guantanamo. So, can you just tell our eager listeners about your work? And the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, the book was the start of my what's now 5 years and counting of working pretty much exclusively on Guantanamo. And I essentially went through the records that were publicly released by the Pentagon. So the names and nationalities of the prisoners.
Uh-huh.
The first time they were released was in March 2006.
Right.
After the prison had been open for over 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that, everybody was in the dark about even who was there.
Right.
They also released 8,000 pages of documents, and they were the allegations against the prisoners, and in some cases they were transcripts of tribunals that had been held at Guantanamo.
Uh-huh.
It was a very unfair process, but it allowed the prisoners themselves to say what they thought of the allegations against them.
Okay.
And from all of that information, really, I was able to build up the big picture of who was in there.
Uh-huh.
A chronology of who was captured where and when, because clearly these weren't the worst of the worst who were all captured on the battlefield.
Right.
It became apparent from actually fairly simple analysis, it became apparent that the majority weren't captured on the battlefield. The majority weren't captured by the Americans. They were captured by their Afghan or Pakistani allies.
Uh-huh.
The Americans were offering bounty payments of $5,000 a head on average for prisoners. The guys weren't screened on arrival according to the Geneva Conventions, competent tribunals, they're called.
Right.
If you capture people not in a battlefield situation, you're supposed to screen them to work out whether you've got civilians or combatants. And the army wanted to do that, but the orders came from on high, from Rumsfeld. No, we're not doing that. Everybody that we capture is guilty. Don't worry. And it was a process of creating a context for these men to put their stories out, really, and to begin to explain what happens when you destroy the myth of the worst of the worst and actually start looking at all the different people who ended up in Guantanamo.
Okay. So, and that's your story too. You were you were sold.
Yes, I was. I was sold in Pakistan. We were surrounded in Pakistan with my family. Child, I had a child of 6 months old in a villa in the house in Pakistan. We were surrounded by Pakistani forces, I think many, many police with guns. And then we were sold on to the Americans who came. They had a delegate from the CIA who looked at everyone who was picked up by the Pakistanis. Every Arab who was in Pakistan at the time was potentially worth something.
Right.
They picked anybody who was in Pakistan at the time. And then they introduced us to the Americans, who then decided how much they would pay for everyone and who would they want to buy. Which they, I think, decided to buy myself. And they took me to, transformed me to Bagram base run by the Americans. And then from there, 2 months in Bagram. Then after that, we went to Guantanamo, ended up in Guantanamo Bay.
Okay. So when did you two first meet? And what were the circumstances in your meeting?
Well, actually, I do remember when we first met, Omar, and it wasn't...
Amnesty, wasn't it?
Probably, no, it was probably not the best of situations. I think it was January 2008. When Omar came back in December 2007, the Spanish immediately filed an extradition request.
Right.
So him and Jamila Banner, another guy who came back in December 2007, on this totally ridiculous basis of some allegations of involvement with terrorism in Spain.
Okay.
So imagine, after 5.5 years in US custody, Omar comes back immediately into this other case, and that took 3 months?
Yeah, more than that, I think.
Until that was dropped, the Spanish dropped it. But I met you, the first time I met you was briefly outside that courtroom.
Yeah, I remember now,
definitely. That was the first time I met him, but I'd written about him, before that.
And then we met more than once in different occasions, and we got to know each other, and then came to trust Andy, saw his work he was doing, which is really very, very powerful, and the only person probably who has gone in depth about the information. He's very familiar with the stuff that is in Guantanamo. When you read his book, you find out the details are there, that as if he has been imprisoned with us, I was saying that. So he was so much into this, and it was impressive, and we met him a couple of times, and then I was silent for 1 year. I never spoke about what happened in Guantanamo so much, because I was told by the lawyers not to speak.
Right.
And there were other reasons. I was complicated things like my family separation. I wasn't psychologically able to, and things like that. Many things that went on. But after a year, Andy always had the idea, I think, he wanted to sit down and ask about other people who are still in Guantanamo.
Right.
And he wanted more information about each person and how they are and who they are. Mm-hmm. And he said to me that, what if we meet and you could tell me about Shakir Ahmed, you could tell me about the others, mention something about them, and I can write about that. So he said yes, and he came with Polly to my house one day. And the intention wasn't completely to be the main, like in the film. I'm talking so much in the film. There was a lot. What wasn't the main was I was going to inform them about certain things, what happened, how things happened in Guantanamo, why the hunger strike, what did happen. And then I think I ended up chatting and talking. It was the first time after 1 year of silence.
Right.
I think I burst out to Andy and Polly talking about everything. And it was interesting that...
Is that the interview that's in the film?
Yeah, some of it is in the film.
Omar, we didn't want to tax him.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, as Omar says, it's like, we'll ask you a few questions about Shaka, about Binyam Muhammad. I mean, a few general comments if you want to make. And I think Omar spoke to us for 5 hours.
In fact, we had a list of questions. And Omar just saying very sort of discreetly, oh, I don't know if I'll really be able to tell you very much. Just talked. This amazing,
that reminds me of my son on a journey to Scotland once, when he spoke for 3 hours non-stop. you did it for 5.5 hours. That's amazing.
That's a breakthrough.
Did that kind of help you psychologically as well?
Definitely. I mean, the whole film itself, the film.
Just the
process. I watched the film more than once, and still, every time I watch it, I think it's very informative. It's more, as I say, it goes more in depth. It doesn't give more attention to, the pictures and screens and how you look and how where you stand.
Yeah.
You have to have a scenery behind you.
Okay.
No, but it more goes into really details. You got people who speak in the film. Not only me. I mean, there are many lawyers.
Yeah.
And Andy and others who speak in the film. They go into, they tell you in details what really did happen.
Right.
And you feel you are informed. So I watched the film. I watched it more than once. And still, every time I watch it, I do get listening into it.
Uh-huh.
So it's a good film. And going around with the film, talking sometimes in Q&As, I think it did help a lot.
Right.
Because you meet lots of people at the same time. Yeah. You get shared experience with them. People mostly are sympathetic, and you know, they make comments about what they think, uh-huh, and what they thought. They thought about the place.
You must lose all faith in humanity.
Definitely, when you're inside in Guantanamo, and when you come across things that we came across, it does have a very deep injury to the soul itself. Uh-huh. I think, but when we were in prison, when we started to get at the end of it, like 2006. Started to get letters from outside. Uh-huh. That was the beginning of introduction to feeling that we're not alone. Not everyone was fooled by what went on.
Yeah.
Not everyone was against us, things like that. Because you feel in Guantanamo, the atmosphere is that you're isolated all the time. You're uh-huh. put into isolation, in cells isolation. You never, even inside prison, you think you're alone. You're fighting everyone alone.
Uh-huh.
And that's really sometimes, but even the closest of your family start sometimes doubt, thinking maybe he went to Chechnya without us knowing that he
right.
was there.
So even your family starts.
Even your family start, because this shows you how powerful is the authorities are.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when something comes from an authority, like
yeah.
a state saying something about somebody,
mm.
The rumor is very difficult sometimes to fight back.
But it's not. I mean, last time I saw you was with the Cage Prisoners Tour
yeah.
with that American guard, which I can remember, Chris Aaron, yeah. yeah.
Most unlikely.
Yeah, and the communication between you and that prison guard,
yeah.
I thought was kind of, you can just cut through all of that authorities.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and it's a very powerful, I don't know, just that human connection. It's very powerful to fight that authoritarian system.
I think it's important to keep that faith in people, that people are people, individuals yeah. are different. And since the Chris Aaron did, we met other guards.
Right.
We met Holbrook, who came from the U.S. to do the same, to apologize and to speak about the things, the mistaken things that they've did in Guantanamo.
Uh-huh.
And there was another guy who came in to meet some of us, Tipton guys.
Right.
So I think it's good to see that, and it's good to keep open like this, because I realize every time, the more days passed, I realized that there are more people. Not everyone was conclusively with the American state.
Uh-huh.
It was a party and was a government, and were certain people who decided that this is the way they wanted to take the U.S. and eventually the whole world to a certain, you know, route which was completely misguided and completely flawed.
Yeah.
And I think the consequence of, everybody can see today that we are all living in the consequence of the stupidity of the Bush administration.
Yeah. Yeah, the criminality of Bush administration.
And he was proudly bragging last time, wasn't he? It's about giving orders about illegal things that you would be embarrassed to openly claim.
Outside the law.
That's
yeah.
why I think he got advice from Obama not to go to European tours, because he might be facing some allegations of uh-huh. Cases. Because
War crimes, because he
openly...
Well, even Boris Johnson warned him not to come to Europe.
Really?
Yeah.
And Blair had a tough time with his book tour, didn't he? You know.
Well, he went to America because he wasn't welcome anywhere else.
Yeah.
They're the only place you can really go if you're a war criminal is
America. Yeah.
Because
the heart of
they
empire.
Have no intention to prosecute war criminals
right.
there, sadly.
Yeah.
Yeah, mentioning that, we tried to have a case in America against even advice of our lawyer, Clive Smith,
uh-huh.
was always telling me, don't forget America, you're not going to get anything there
right.
for the time being, for
uh-huh.
this time. But we, against all his advisors, we went and contacted lawyers. We tried to bring cases against the lawyers and the legal team who advised them
yeah.
to legalize torture. And, you know, eventually we didn't succeed because it just all went quiet and
right.
being pressurized, I think, to drop the whole case.
Yeah.
But eventually I think people come to their senses, and maybe one day we would see Bush and Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney.
Let's hope so.
In something like yeah. Hague or something like that.
Yeah.
It's funny because I've been to
Nuremberg.
The States a few times, and the last time I was over, I was in Berkeley in the Bay Area in October.
Uh-huh.
Of a whole week of events against torture. And it's where John Yoo, who is one of the... He was a lawyer in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. It's
right.
the department that advises the executive branch on what's legal and what isn't.
Oh, yeah.
And while he was there, he wrote the memo, the secret memo, that twisted the definition of torture so that it could be practiced. And he's now a law professor in Berkeley, and tenured law professor. You know, happily
spreading, that's his reward.
Spreading his poison there. You know, but I mean, apart from, you know, the rather dispiriting thing that so many people in America don't know or don't care or actually think it was a good thing. The difficult thing, and it really struck me this time, was that actually, you know, it sounds a bit dramatic, but actually the issue of torture is really at the heart of what is a battle for the soul of America. Because when you don't fully repudiate what happened and make accountable those who initiated it, as has happened, and when you allow it to be spread, this message that actually torture did work, as Bush is trying to pretend, and that, you know, tough guys do torture because that's what you have to do, and the existential crisis we face is such that it really is the only... That message is still surviving.
Okay.
And, you know, and within the States, those people are, I think, if anything, getting kind of more hysterical as time goes on.
That's worrying.
You know, in their opposition to Obama, they've chosen, we can do national security, we can do this stuff. He's soft. He's not actually soft, but the way they play it is that, you know, they can be tougher than tough. So now they capture a terrorist suspect, like they did a year ago when a guy tried to blow himself up on a plane with
the Christmas bomb.
Rudimentary failed bomb in his underwear. But they capture a guy like that, and instead of understanding that, you know, that this is terrorism, it's a crime, that you allow law enforcement officials to come and interrogate this person non-coercively, the same way that everything always used to happen, the same way that actually things were happening under Bush, even, for a lot of terrorism-related cases. Instead of that, now the hysterical response is like, no, 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 don't give him his Miranda rights. Don't let him have any rights. Send him to Guantanamo. Why is he not being waterboarded? You know, I mean, this is serious. These are serious points that these people are making. They're not joking. You know,
it's and not it, just and Fox News.
It's part of how it just demonstrates to me why this has to be repudiated at some point, you know, thoroughly. I mean, it really does have to be brought to an end, because the fear that I have now, the way that America is going, is that there's nothing really to stop the strength of this rightward drift. You know, and the more it carries on, the more it's sweeping up essentially the baser elements of society. You know, and coarsening all debate and coarsening the people, I think.
Thank you. Finishing the sentence.
Sorry, I interrupted.
Can I bring Michael in? Why are you here, Michael? I don't know you. Just let me know why you're here.
I am a historian at the University of Sheffield, and we started a Center for Peace History last year. So that's the kind of official co-sponsorship of this event that's going on tonight. But I'm also an organizer for Witness Against Torture, and have been for the last, like, 4 years. So we've been involved in the campaign for a long time. We don't ever get to meet former prisoners because they're not allowed back in the United States. So a number of my friends were writing to me, very excited in anticipation that I was going to get to do this and be here tonight with you. So it's part of a, I mean, for us, for In Witness Against Torture, it's obviously part of an effort to reach out and maintain relationships with groups around the world that have been engaged in the same kind of work. And I think, actually, we don't probably do the best job of that on the whole, I think.
You don't do the best job.
No, I don't. I mean, I think we're severely strained in terms of resources, and we do what we can. None of us feel like it's enough, but we know enough to know that there are groups like us all over the world. Working towards the same result, and it's very difficult to sort of reach across national borders in spite of much heralded, you know, new technologies that make it easier to communicate. It's still very difficult to organize, you know, and I feel like if we could bring the power of all those people to bear across borders, we may be more successful. But
the struggle goes on.
I mean, you take a very powerful message to the American people within America. You know, I mean, of like, I mean, really, absolutely no nonsense opposition to torture, and the, you know, the theatrics, for want of a better word. But I mean, it's very heartfelt as well. I mean, you're, you know, it's very emotionally charged. right. trying to present that to the American people. Right. And it is the American people who are the most important part of this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could argue about that. Because I think we've been, you know, year after year, we go to Washington, D.C., and on the January 11th, on the anniversary every year, we have scores of people arrested wearing orange jumpsuits and black hoods. Don't bring their own identification. Give the name of a detainee when they're arraigned mm-hmm. so that we bring the names of the detainees into the court system. We get minimal press coverage mm-hmm. for that from the mainstream media. We do not reach the public the way that we think we ought to and the way that past campaigns for social justice do. And so, I mean, an ongoing kind of debate within the organization is this actually going to happen
right.
from within the United States? Maybe the pressure needs to come from outside the United States. Enough evidence to demonstrate that this is an embarrassment to the United States, that it's a crime against humanity, and that the rest of the international community isn't going to stand for it. And that's also obviously a difficult, you know, mobilization to make mm-hmm. happen on some level when there's so many other competing crises.
Aren't the British and Americans trying to push for other countries to accept this kind of treatment?
Well, they said,
aren't, you know, the governments of the UK and the US putting pressure on other governments to kind of condone this?
Demonstrated that they were basically like bargaining over this, right? Mm-hmm. We'll give you access. You can have a luncheon with some low-level functionary in the State Department if you agree to accept some detainee uh-huh. to mm-hmm. you know, to your country. Mm-hmm. But they haven't been too totally successful at that. Obviously, a few countries have participated, but I think the Obama administration made a decision over a year ago that this was not going to work out, and it was for them, you know, political death to keep pushing it.
Okay.
You know? And so I think they've stopped. I think they actually aren't trying at all anymore to try to get detainees accepted mm-hmm. elsewhere.
Right.
There might be a little flurry of activity in January, because there always seems to be on the anniversary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. A few more third countries may be found.
Right.
No, it is, you know, it's pretty bleak.
It's
and, you know, because if the prospect is, these are the Democrats.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, then what
well,
we
personally, I have no faith in any of that political system. To me, it's a ruling class top down.
Yeah,
They're capitalists, corporate capitalists, and that's all they're interested in. Well,
and the sad fact is, like, people who are locked up now for 9 years, like Shakil Ahmed. He's been locked up for 9 years, cleared for release. How many? For more than
three years.
He's cleared for release.
And the UK say we want him back and are not putting pressure on.
They're not pushing hard enough. Right. Otherwise, they would have been released to the UK probably.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the interesting things that came out from your
discussions.
Yeah, was that the Labour government had been saying for years, we're talking, we're trying,
mm-hmm.
and it was sprung on officials in the government departments who actually didn't really know what was going on. The files had been gathering dust.
Right.
So
until recently, Hague, because in the settlement we said that we were not prepared to settle if Shakil Ahmed is not brought back to this country.
Okay.
Where he has four children here.
Yeah.
And one of his children he has never seen, and his family is here, he lives here. And it's very sad to see the continuation of this thing happening, and the innocent people there who are cleared for release. People who have not been convicted of anything after 9 years,
mm-hmm.
still locked up in such a prison. So we're trying our best to get them out from there, to talk about their case.
So it's an ongoing campaign.
And Shaka's, you know, Shaka's the man who has this. He's British. I mean, he's a British resident. He doesn't mm-hmm. have the passport. But
okay.
as Omar says, his wife is British.
Mm-hmm.
His four children
are British.
Yeah.
He lived here,
and he's had the full support of his MP right from the start.
But he's the best opportunity for people in Britain to think we can do something here.
Okay.
And I really think we can do something here. But, you know, the sad thing in terms of the bigger picture is that over half of the remaining 174 men in Guantanamo have been cleared for release.
Okay.
Mm.
Mostly in the last year or so by the Obama administration, which has ticked the box that says, yes, these guys can go, but you know, as Mike was saying, it's ground to a halt in the States now. Even getting Shaka Armour out of there feels like you're going to have to prize him out of the place because really, the Obama administration said not even releasing a single guy is so much flack.
Right.
Why would we bother?
Okay. You know? So what can
nobody's
we do?
Pushing for
what,
it.
What can we do?
we can push for the return of Shaka Arma. You know, uh-huh. I mean, there's a financial settlement that he's included in. How can that be the case when he's not here?
Uh-huh.
There's a Metropolitan Police investigation ongoing into his allegations that came out in a court case a year ago here.
Mm-hmm.
That British agents were present in the room when he was being brutally treated by the Americans in a prison in Afghanistan before going to Guantanamo. And David Cameron wants to draw a line mm-hmm. under British complicity in torture by having a judicial inquiry
mm-hmm.
led by, you know, his friend Sir Peter Gibson, whose previous job was investigating the intelligence services.
Okay.
He's going to investigate them.
But yeah. this is all about. The settlement was about stopping the civil claim that was brought by Omar and these guys so that this judicial inquiry can go ahead. This can't go ahead without evidence from one of the people mm-hmm. whose evidence is needed,
right?
Which is Shaka Arma, and he's in Guantanamo.
Let's get him home.
So, you know, I think every day, writing to our MPs, writing to William Hague,
mm-hmm.
hammering away at all of this to say, well, what's your excuse today? Because your excuse today is no better than it was yesterday. I should be picking my paper up in the morning, Mr. Hague, and seeing the headline, Shaka Arma back in UK.
Uh-huh. Well, it gives me an opportunity to slag off my local MP, Meg Munn, who is a total war criminal, and complicit with the Blairites, and any asylum seeker case, she just doesn't want to know. Sure. She's an evil, evil woman. And
unlike the
in Sheffield, that's bad news.
It is. And she's Labour, you know, so-called.
So unlike the MP we have in Brighton, Green Party MP.
Right.
Yeah, you're Caroline
Lucas. Yeah. Which
you're so lucky that everybody hasn't moved to Brighton. Seriously, the population of Britain, everybody reasonable.
She has in Parliament, she has an early,
I'll be in Brighton.
Early day motion that is supported by lots of handful of MPs, and we would encourage people to write to their MPs to support the motion that she's bringing in Parliament, and which is a good different things to speak about. I mean, you say your MP is rubbish, our MP is a bit better than that, and she's doing a lot of good job.
And if people want to find out information about all these letters and ways to do it, then my website's good, which is andyworthington.co.uk. Or cage prisoners is good as well.
You've got a website, I presume?
WitnessTorture.org. Uh-huh. Yep, I can give you flyers and stuff. We're planning for... sorry, these got cut off a little bit. Planning for a vigil in Washington. 11-12-day vigil.
I'll be there.
Andy's going to be there. Yep, so I will see you there. Yep.
And there's also...
Did you get trouble?
Richard,
no, not yet.
Save the Shaka Arma campaign, which is ssac.contact@googlemail.com.
Right.
And they're a really incredibly hardworking bunch of people.
For Shaka's release. Yeah. They're Londoners who are from Battersea, where Shaka comes from, and they're campaigning hard to bring attention to his case and to, you know, write to MPs and do some work on his case.
But with the David Miliband stock letter that he writes to people who write about this, it says we as a government have taken more detainees back from Guantanamo than anybody other country
else.
Which is, we've taken back our own citizens.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That's what we should do.
Yeah.
We haven't taken a single person that isn't either a British citizen or a long-term British resident who has a very, very strong connection to the country. So sometimes Ahmed Belbashda, who has very much lesser
but he has, you know,
has no
where else is no this man going to go? If he's terrified of returning to Algeria and everybody knows that, then the only country that he lived in peacefully without causing any trouble working for nearly 2 years is the UK.
Right.
But, you know, persuading the British government to do that is you know, I know.
What about the Russians and the Eastern Europeans still there? I mean, are there campaigns going on for all these people as well?
For who is who?
You know, I heard there were some Russians at Guantanamo.
Yeah, well, there's one Russian left.
One Russian.
Yeah, there's just one still there.
Okay.
But the Russians who went back to Russia, they had a hard time. Some of them died. They were killed.
Yeah, yeah.
Shot and in front of their mosque. One of them is in front of a mosque. Another one is locked up in Siberia. And the others are, they're all having a hard time. Another one ran away to live in Egypt as a refugee. And the Russians are not, they all gave the same promises as when. That's why we're saying it's very necessary for us to not repatriate those people to their own countries if there is danger.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what happened with the Russian people. Mm-hmm. They were sent back to Russia and they were really badly mistreated.
But that's why, you know, it would be logical, it would be just if the British government did take somebody other than just Shaka Armour, but we really must get him back first. Because I think it's 16 countries around the world have taken 37 men who had no connection with those countries as part of the you know, helping President Obama to close Guantanamo. And we've seen from WikiLeaks that some of those deals were certainly about as far from humanitarian concerns as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, with resultant problems. When there's so much horse trading going on and apparently $85,000 per detainee and all this arm twisting, then I think you can see that the men's welfare is not necessarily top of the priorities. But, you know, these are problems that you know, a number of groups are looking at. But I think the overall notion of what's been happening with resettlement of these people who are put in this terrible position where they can't return home is a bad mark against the British government, because mm-hmm. we haven't, you know. Mm-hmm. And it rubbed it in, I think, Polly, when David Miliband used to say
that's hideous.
You know, we've done more than anyone. Standing on a pedestal, hectoring the rest of Europe.
Right.
What a great British position to be in.
But I have a question for you, because you're from Sheffield.
Yeah.
This is a city of sanctuary, right? So, obviously, it wasn't set up with the idea that you'd be taking free detainees from Guantanamo, but why couldn't it be? Why couldn't their pressure come from local city councils in cities of sanctuary to say to the Cameron government, we want these people, right? This is part of our brief as a city of sanctuary.
Yeah,
and maybe that's something we ought to bring up in the discussion.
Probably not in the ward where you have a war criminal Labour MP, but presumably.
Meg Bunn.
Right.
The Munn. Well,
that's interesting.
No, but that's
coming, isn't it? Very interesting way of putting it.
Yeah,
it's a great idea. I mean, I like that, you know, it's been happening in the States in a few places, isn't it?
Well, that's why I thought about it. I didn't even know until recently that this was a city of sanctuary, but one of the groups we do work with in the U.S. is this No More Guantanamo's group, and that's what they do, is they go around city council, town council at a time and get them to vote.
I think they're the only one in the country, aren't they?
Is this the only city of sanctuary in the country?
I think so.
Well, all the more reason.
Oh, it's a great idea.
So we should, maybe we can float that at the Q&A after the film or something and see if there's any traction.
Yeah, I'll help you out as well. We've got 90 guys in Guantanamo.
Okay, we'll get them all back.
We're all looking for somewhere to go.
Exactly.
Well, thanks, gentlemen, and Polly. And I'll just conclude it there. I think I've got enough editing to do now. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Yeah. That's really great.